and welcome to Crime Monthly presents Evil Uncovered, where each week we delve into real-life stories that reveal the darkest depths of human nature. In this episode, we explore the harrowing experiences of those who have been imprisoned against their will, some forced to summon incredible resilience in captivity, and some who lost their lives to a particular kind of evil. Join us as we uncover three stories of endurance, tragedy, and the strength of the human spirit. Listener discretion is advised. Our first story takes us to California in the late spring of 1977, where a young woman's decision to hitch a ride would be the start of a true nightmare. It was a warm day in May when 20-year-old Colleen Stan set out from her home in Eugene, Oregon, to head to a friend's birthday party in Northern California. The self-confessed teenage tomboy had grown into an independent young woman, a free spirit, and she had no reason to be concerned for her safety on the road. Back then, hitchhiking was common practice all across the United States. Colleen had already covered 300 miles and was only 100 miles from her destination when a blue Dodge Colt pulled up. Inside were 23-year-old Cameron Hooker, his 19-year-old wife Janice, and their 8-month-old baby. Feeling safe with the young family, Colleen got in. But she wasn't safe at all, and that ride was to be the start of an ordeal that would last 2,634 days. Years later, Colleen would describe that fateful first encounter, explaining that she got a bad feeling not long after the car set off with her in the back seat. She said,
"I looked in the rear view and I could see the driver checking me out. It sent a cold shiver down my spine. They both kept asking me how old I was, where was I from, and where was I going. I didn't ask them anything. I didn't even know their names."
After driving for a while, Hooker stopped to get petrol and Colleen took the opportunity to use the restroom. It was in that garage bathroom that she experienced an inexplicable burst of gut instinct, a sudden voice in her head that told her to run and not look back. Devastatingly, she shook it off as her imagination, and when she got back in the car, she saw something disturbing.
On the seat, there was a wooden box that hadn't been there before. I looked at it, but kind of chose to ignore it.
She could not have been able to imagine what the 20-pound hinged wooden contraption would be used for. After convincing Colleen they were taking a detour to see some local caves, the Hookers drove to a remote woodland area where Janice got out with the baby. Then Cameron Hooker pounced. Jumping in the back seat, he put a knife to Colleen's throat and said unless she did what he told her, she would die. He then ordered her to lie down and placed that wooden box over Colleen's head, leaving her barely able to breathe or see. When Janice came back to the car and calmly got in, Colleen realised the young woman knew exactly what her husband had planned and was part of it. The pair drove Colleen to their home in Red Bluff, California. Here, she was marched into the basement, where her ordeal would get yet more terrifying. Hooker stripped Colleen, attached leather restraints to her wrists, then suspended her from the ceiling. He proceeded to whip her, threatening that if she screamed, he would cut her vocal cords. Terrified, she complied with his sick demands. Chillingly, Hooker and Janice then had sex while Colleen was still tied up. There would be no relief when Colleen was eventually taken down, as Hooker placed the dreadful box back on her head, then forced her inside a wooden crate. Left alone, Colleen struggled to breathe and was almost overwhelmed by panic. Terrified she would die in there, she forced herself to remain calm. It was the beginning of a cycle of abuse designed to break her spirit, yet she would endure and keep fighting to stay alive. Meanwhile, Colleen's family and friends had realized she was missing and alerted the police. When they could find no trace of her, her parents began driving along the route she would have taken, but they would find nothing. After 2 months, they began to fear their daughter was dead. They had no idea she was trapped in a living hell, hidden in a basement and enduring whatever torture Hooker could think up. 8 months after abducting Colleen, Hooker revealed the next part of his plan. He told Colleen,
I'm part of something. A group we call The Company. It's a dangerous organization, and they won't hesitate to kill you and everyone you love unless you do what I tell you.
He also presented her with a contract that declared her to be his forever slave. After enduring months of hell, Colleen believed everything her captor said and signed the document. Now she belonged to him, Colleen was allowed to move around in the main house and soon got the sense Janice was not happy with the arrangement. And when Hooker began raping Colleen, Janice got angry. Colleen would later learn that while Janice had allowed Hooker to abduct and keep Colleen as a slave if Janice was allowed to have another baby, he was not supposed to have sex with her. It was a crack in the relationship that would widen as time went on, especially as Hooker was physically abusing his wife. In 1978, the couple moved into a mobile home, taking Colleen with them. There, she was forced to sleep in a box under their bed and was let out only to do chores and babysit. Although she went outside, she believed she was being watched by the company, so didn't try to run away. The extent of Hooker's influence was most apparent in 1981, when after 4 years in captivity, he allowed Colleen to go back home for one night. Terrified she would place her family in danger if she didn't comply, she introduced Hooker as her boyfriend and even posed for a photo with him. Over the next 3.5 years, Colleen was allowed to take a job as a cleaner at a nearby motel, but again, fear stopped her trying to escape. She spent much of her time in the box beneath the couple's bed, praying to survive. Then something miraculous did happen. By 1984, Janice was getting increasingly frustrated with what she saw simply as a three-way relationship and spoke to her pastor about it. He told her God would not approve of the way they were living, so one day when Hooker was out, Janice told Colleen the horrifying truth. The company did not exist. Hooker had made it up to exert his awful control of her, Colleen would later say.
I couldn't believe I'd believed him all those years. On the 10th of August, 1984, I went to the bus station, and before I boarded a bus home, I phoned Hooker, telling him I was leaving. He bawled like a baby.
Despite spending 7 years in captivity, Colleen couldn't bring herself to go to the police about Hooker. But Janice did. She left him and told the police what he had done. But that wasn't all. She also revealed they'd abducted another woman 16 months before Colleen, Marie Elizabeth Spanicky, who disappeared in January 1976. Janice revealed they had picked her up hitchhiking and taken her back to their home. Down in that basement, Hooker had threatened to cut her vocal cords, just as he had done with Colleen. This time, he carried out the threat, and Marie died. Her body was never found, so police were unable to bring charges for her murder, but they did arrest Hooker for Colleen's kidnap. When they picked him up, they found he had been digging a hole in the floor of his property. He was making plans to abduct another woman. Hooker went on trial in 1985, and jurors were shocked by Colleen's graphic and heart-rending testimony. News reports would say,
Colleen Stand today took to the stand to describe in detail what happened to her during her captivity, including torture, whippings, and electrocution. The jurors were visibly shocked when they were shown the box under the bed that Colleen had been forced to live in, as well as the wooden contraption that was routinely placed over her head.
Colleen's testimony should have been enough to get Hooker convicted. But he sensationally claimed that they'd fallen for each other, and Colleen had willingly stayed with him. The defense even produced love letters allegedly written by Colleen, but the prosecution brought in a forensic psychologist as an expert witness, who said,
Those feelings were not real. It's my opinion that Colleen would have been experiencing Stockholm Syndrome after the years of systematic abuse she was subjected to.
After deliberating for almost 3 days, the jury found Hooker guilty. Calling him the most dangerous psychopath he'd ever encountered, the judge sentenced him to 104 years behind bars. But in 2021, a spokesperson for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation said,
Cameron Hooker was released from prison to parole on the 27th of September. However, he is not on parole supervision in the community. He is currently in the custody of the California Department of State Hospitals undergoing sexual violent predator proceedings pursuant to state law.
As this podcast was recorded, Hooker was due to go on trial to determine if he was still a sexually violent predator. Prosecutors said that if Hooker was deemed to still be a danger, he'll remain in prison. If not, he would be released into a halfway home. Janice Hooker was given immunity from prosecution in return for testifying and went on to work in mental health. As for Colleen, we can only imagine how she found the resilience to survive her horror ordeal. But she now lives in California, a grandmother who tries every day to forget what happened to her. As we leave the ordeal of Colleen Stan, we stay in California for our second story where, in the summer of 1985, police searching for a missing man arrived at a remote cabin in the Sierra Nevada foothills. They could have no idea of the depravity soon to unfold, a tale of incomprehensible evil involving women kept as sex slaves and a trench full of human remains. The story begins on November the 2nd, 1984, when 40-year-old San Francisco car dealer Paul Cosner vanished without a trace. He was supposed to be going on a date night with his girlfriend Marilyn, but never showed up. She would later say,
"I called his sister Sharon to see if she knew where he was, but she hadn't heard from him either. We were worried, but not panicked. Not yet."
There was, however, one niggling doubt. The day before, Paul had mentioned he was meeting a man who'd responded to an ad he'd placed in the San Francisco Chronicle. Paul was selling his brown Honda Prelude, and something about the potential buyer had seemed a little unsettling. Things took a turn when Marilyn and Sharon arrived at Paul's home. They were immediately struck by how clean it was, and Paul was definitely not known for his tidiness. And then they noticed the Honda Prelude was missing. Sharon said,
"We called the police, but they told us they didn't have the resources to investigate an adult disappearance. They said Paul would come back when he was ready, but we knew something was wrong."
Sharon's intuition proved to be chillingly accurate. For the next week, she kept visiting Paul's home, hoping for a sign of him. Then, 7 days after his disappearance, she found a new message on his answering machine. It simply said, Sharon immediately called police, and this time they took her seriously. But with almost nothing to go on, the investigation hit a brick wall. Sharon managed to get local news stations to appeal for information, and it was through a reporter that she learned of a disturbing connection.
"I was able to tell Sharon that back in July, a man named Harvey Dubbs, his wife Deborah, and their baby son Sean had all gone missing after Harvey placed an ad in that very same newspaper, this time renting out some video equipment. A neighbor saw two men carrying the equipment out of the house, loading it into the family's own car, and driving away. A little while later, their bank card was used at a restaurant, and employees described the diners as a white man and an Asian man. The car was later found abandoned."
Police feared the worst, but it wasn't until months after Paul's disappearance that they would get a break in the case. On June the 2nd, 1985, police were called to a lumberyard after an Asian man stole a vise and loaded it into the boot of a brown Honda Prelude. By the time an officer arrived, the suspect had fled, but another man, who identified himself as Lonnie Bond, claimed it was all a misunderstanding. However, the officer insisted on looking in the car boot.
"When I checked the trunk, I found a gun with an illegal silencer. The driving license the man gave me was in the name of Robin Stapley, but the car was registered to Paul Cosner, who we knew was missing. I immediately took the suspect into custody."
Under arrest, the man admitted that his real name was Leonard Lake and revealed the person who'd fled was his friend, Charles Eng. A fugitive who'd skipped bail on firearms charges, Lake was a man whose sadistic tendencies had surfaced early in life. Born in 1945, Lake's parents divorced when he was 6 years old, and he and his siblings moved in with their grandmother. As a child, Lake enjoyed dissolving small animals in acid, and as he got older, he developed an obsession with pornography. He took nude photographs of his own sisters, even going on to force them to commit sexual acts. Following his graduation in 1964, Lake enlisted in the Marines and did two tours of Vietnam. But after suffering what medics called a delusional breakdown, he was medically discharged and later diagnosed with a schizoid personality. He drifted around hippie communes for the next few years and eventually got married. But the marriage ended when his wife discovered he was making and starring in amateur bondage films. Lake went to prison for stealing a car in 1980, then headed to another commune in California where he met his second wife. She indulged his sexual fantasies, even joining in with making pornographic films. Around this time, Lake met Eng, who answered an ad Lake had placed in a survivalist magazine. It's possible Lake may have intended Eng to be one of his victims, but it was instead a meeting of two dark minds. Born in Hong Kong in 1960, Eng was the son of a wealthy businessman, but was frequently in trouble. As a teenager, he was caught stealing multiple times and was expelled from several schools. At 18, he went to study in the United States, but soon dropped out. After being arrested over a hit-and-run incident, Eng ran away and joined the Marines. A year later, he was caught stealing automatic weapons. Facing a court-martial, he fled custody and headed for California, where he met Lake, eventually moving in with him and his wife. After being arrested at the lumberyard, Lake was questioned over Paul Cosner's disappearance. He offered to write a full confession on the condition he was left alone to do it. But when the officers returned, they found him convulsing on the floor, having taken a cyanide pill. Soon he'd slipped into a coma, and the police needed another way to find out what had happened to Paul. But they were about to catch a break.
We found a utility bill for a cabin in Wilseyville, California, that we could tie to Lake. We headed there on June the 4th, completely unprepared for what would happen next.
A single-story cabin nestled in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains. As soon as investigators entered, they saw bloodstains on the ceiling and a bullet hole in the floor. They also found multiple TVs and videos, and when they checked the serial numbers, they realized it was the equipment that had been stolen from Harvey Dubbs. Suspecting something terrible had happened there, they applied for a search warrant, and as soon as it came through, they set about exploring the surrounding grounds. Close to the cabin, they found a crude cinder block structure. After Lake's experiences in Vietnam, he'd become obsessed with the idea of an impending nuclear war and built a survival shelter. But when officers entered, they realized it was smaller inside than out. It was then they found the door leading to a hidden bunker.
We opened that door, and what we found would haunt us forever.
Pinned up on the wall were rows of photographs, each showing a different woman. Another locked door stood at the end of the room, and when they broke it open, they recoiled in horror. They were standing at the entrance to a makeshift cell, housing a bed and a bucket for a toilet.
Taped to the door of that cell was a list of typed instructions that read, 1. I must always be ready to service my master. I must be clean, brushed, and made up. 2. I must never speak unless spoken to. Unless in bed, I must never look my master in the eye, but must keep my eyes downcast. 3. I must never show my disrespect, either verbally or silent. I must never cross my arms or legs in front of my body or clench my fists, and unless eating, must always keep my lips parted. 4. I must be obedient completely and in all things. I must obey immediately and without question or complaint. 5. I must always be quiet when locked in my cell. 6. I must remember and obey any additional rules told to me. I must understand that any disobedience, any pain, trouble, or annoyance caused by me to my master will be grounds for punishment. We realized then that at least some of the women in those photos had been abducted and kept in there as sex slaves.
Recording equipment was also found inside the room, a silent witness to the unspeakable acts that had occurred there. But there was more horror yet to be uncovered on the sprawling grounds. Behind the cabin, law enforcement had found a 100-foot trench filled with what initially looked like rubbish. But as officers dug deeper, a cry rang out.
We've got a skull here!
The trench was in fact a mass grave filled with charred human bones and personal items belonging to Lake and Eng's many victims. Among them, the officers found a pair of glasses and a wallet belonging to Paul Cosner. As they continued to excavate, more remains emerged, each one a testament to the unimaginable cruelty that had taken place there. The press was alerted, and soon more reports of missing people began to surface. Among them were the family from the cabin next door, Lonnie Bond Sr., his girlfriend Brenda, and their one-year-old baby, Lonnie Bond Jr. Also missing was their friend Robin Stapley, the identity on Lake's driver's license when he was arrested. In all, the bodies of 7 men, 3 women, and 2 babies, plus 45 pounds of bone fragments, were found at that lonely cabin site. One of the most chilling discoveries would come in the form of a 5-gallon drum containing 2 VHS tapes. When the officers played the tapes on the Dubs family's stolen equipment, Leonard Lake appeared on the screen. Settling himself into an armchair, he spoke directly into the camera as he outlined what he called Project Miranda. Lake's plan had been to create what he deemed the perfect woman, one who was completely compliant and obedient. He called this woman a Miranda. Posing as a photographer, Lake would lure women to the remote woodland location, where he and Eng would kill her husband and even her child. The woman would then be kept captive in the dungeon and subjected to unimaginable horrors before being shot dead. Speaking in a detached and expressionless voice on the videotape, Lake said,
"Anyone who wants my rationalization or justification as to why I want to enslave a young woman have only to look closely at me. I am attracted to a particular type of woman who is totally uninterested in me, young women. As young as 12, although 18 to 22, is pretty much ideal as far as my tastes go."
Lake's manifesto continued for 15 harrowing minutes, laying out his twisted vision.
"What I want is an off-the-shelf sex partner. I want to be able to use the woman whenever and however I want. And when I'm bored, I simply want to put her away."
It was a horrifying revelation, but Leonard Lake would never stand trial for his heinous crimes as he died of cyanide poisoning. Police put out alerts for Charles Eng, and he was eventually arrested in Canada on July the 6th, 1985, after shooting a security guard who tried to stop him shoplifting. Eng was extradited to the United States in 1991, but spent the next 8 years doing everything he could to delay the trial, including firing his lawyers and applying to defend himself. When he finally went on trial in 1998, jurors would hear awful details of the depraved duo's crimes.
As Charles Eng sat emotionless in the courtroom, family members of the victims wept while the prosecution and defense outlined their cases. Excerpts played from recovered videotapes showing the men abusing abducted women caused gasps of shock before the court heard that the vice Eng had been attempting to steal was to replace one they'd broken while torturing their victims. Authorities found the remains of at least 19 people in their cabin, east of San Francisco.
In 1999, Eng was convicted of 11 murders and sentenced to death. Aged 63, he remains on death row at San Quentin Prison. It's estimated that as many as 25 people fell victim to Lake and Eng's depravity, and the horrifying discoveries at that isolated cabin were a grim reminder of the cruelty some people are capable of. It was a case that would haunt all those involved for years to come and leave a lingering question: how could such evil go unnoticed for so long? So, as we close this dark chapter, we remember the victims and all the families left to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives.
Crime Monthly magazine is dedicated to all things true crime, where you'll find all the latest news, in-depth features, interviews with leading experts, and so much more. We've even got your essential entertainment guide for the month ahead. Buy in all good shops and supermarkets or subscribe now at greatmagazines.co.uk.
Our final story takes place in Lugoff in South Carolina, where in late 2006, the life of 14-year-old Elizabeth Schoaf would forever be changed. On the afternoon of Wednesday, the 6th of September, Elizabeth stepped off the school bus, just like she did every day. Her mother Madeline was at work, but had issued strict instructions for her daughter to go straight home, where her 12-year-old brother Donnie would be waiting. As she walked those 200 yards, the schoolgirl's mind was lightly filled with the exciting plans she had coming up. Her aunt was coming over to cut her hair, and the next day, they would all be celebrating her cousin's birthday. She even waved to some friends driving past in their car, completely unaware of the danger lurking in the bushes just feet away. Madeline always called home around the time the children arrived back, but when Donnie and not Elizabeth answered, it sent a chill through her veins. She would later say,
"Donnie said Elizabeth wasn't home yet, so I asked him to run up to the top of the driveway to see if he could see her. He didn't come back to the phone, so then I started getting worried."
Madeline and her husband Don headed home, and with still no sign of Elizabeth, organized for family members to go out searching. She later said,
"Everybody came over, picked their spot, and started searching. We were in the woods, knocking on every door. We went everywhere we could think of, but it felt hopeless."
They reported Elizabeth missing to the police, only to be told she had probably run away. They insisted she would never do that, and a search was launched. Sniffer dogs were brought in but failed to pick up the teenager's scent. It was as if she had vanished into thin air. At first light, the search intensified, with hundreds of people volunteering to help and helicopters scouring the area from the air. The woods all around there were dense, making it tough to navigate. But there was someone lurking who knew those woods like the back of his hand, a predator with truly dark intent. 36-year-old unemployed construction worker Vincent Fillior was a man with a grudge. Unemployed and embittered, his life was a series of failures and frustrations. Known to local police after previously being accused of sexual assault, Fillior felt wronged by the authorities, and as his resentment festered, he hatched a terrible plan to take revenge. Living in that remote woodland, he'd been meticulously constructing hidden bunkers among the dense trees, preparing for a crime that would shock the nation, and seeing Elizabeth get off that bus as he hid in the bushes, he decided she would be his victim. Wearing camouflage green clothing and posing as a police officer, Phil Yaw approached Elizabeth. Flashing a fake badge, he told her she was under arrest because her family was suspected of growing drugs. Phil Yaw handcuffed Elizabeth and led her into the dense woods. As the trees closed in around them, in the isolation of the forest, Fillior's true nature revealed itself. He raped Elizabeth before forcing her to put on a necklace he claimed was laden with explosives and would detonate if she tried to escape. Fillior then marched Elizabeth deeper into the woods to an underground bunker 6 feet below the surface. Equipped with a bed, stove, television, and even an escape route that would enable him to run if necessary, this terrifying lair would become Elizabeth's prison. The police would later say,
"The bunker was crude but well camouflaged. It was clear he had planned this for a long time."
For more than a week, Elizabeth remained captive down there with Fillior, undiscovered despite the frantic efforts of her family and law enforcement, searching sometimes literally above their heads. After 6 days, they were fearing the worst, with law enforcement saying,
"As the days went on, we got that policeman's feeling, that gut feeling, that it really looked like it was going to turn out bad."
But Elizabeth's parents refused to give up and were continuing to search far and wide. Madeline would often find herself praying in the darkness, saying,
"In the middle of the night, I would get up and walk out of my driveway. I would walk across the street and stand there looking across to Charm Hill. I'd pray there in the dark, just praying that she would come back safe."
They could have no idea of the ordeal Elizabeth was being subjected to, or the resilience their bright, clever, and resourceful girl was summoning. The bunker she was held in was covered in plastic tarpaulin, with makeshift wooden ladders providing access to the ground level. Phil Yore controlled Elizabeth through fear, telling her the bunker was booby-trapped with explosives and threatening to find and shoot her younger brother if she tried to escape. Elizabeth's ordeal was a nightmare of repeated sexual assaults and constant threats. Yet, amid the darkness, she found a way to fight back. She befriended her captor, persuading him to allow her small freedoms, like bathing in a nearby pond. It was during these moments that she left strands of her hair on branches, hoping that sniffer dogs might catch the scent. Elizabeth's masterstroke came when she convinced Phil Yore to let her use his mobile phone to play games. There was no signal in the bunker, but she bided her time, waiting for the right moment. After more than a week of captivity, Phil Yore fell asleep. Seizing the opportunity, Elizabeth climbed up from her underground prison. Back in the family home, Madeline was just about to head to a vigil for her daughter. Describing that moment, she would later say,
"As I left, I picked up my cell phone and grabbed my keys. I was heading out the door and I happened to look at my cell phone when I saw I had a text."
Elizabeth had managed to thrust her hand above ground level and send a message to her mother saying,
"Hi, Mom, it's Lizzie. I'm in a hole down by the road or by Charm Hill, the road where the big trucks go in and out."
The police immediately began to trace the signal, and the sheriff would later say,
"We were able to triangulate between three cell towers in the area and get the number. And when the number came back, that's when the big break came. We knew exactly who we were looking for."
Phil Yore was already being looked into on suspicion of sexually assaulting his own stepdaughter, and police raced to his trailer home. There, among pornography and evidence of drug and alcohol use, they made a startling discovery. Cut into the floor under a mattress was a hole leading outside, and when they eventually uncovered the extent of Phil Yore's web of underground bunkers, the sheriff said,
"We had someone who'd already committed criminal sexual conduct and who had another victim somewhere doubtless doing the same thing. We felt he was progressing to become a serial killer and had absolutely no idea if we would find this young lady alive."
On the ninth night of Elizabeth's captivity, Phil Yore saw himself on the evening news, the prime suspect in her disappearance. The sound of police helicopters overhead confirmed the net was closing in, and in a bizarre twist, he asked Elizabeth what he should do. She told him to run because if they caught him, he would go to jail. Incredibly, Phil Yore did just that. He fled, leaving Elizabeth locked in that underground dungeon, but the courageous girl was not ready to give up. She waited until dawn and then pushed her way out of her prison. She was 10 minutes away from her own home. As the police searched the area on horseback, they heard something incredible. Elizabeth's voice yelling for help. One officer recalled,
"I knew it was her. I could feel it was her. I would have walked through hell on a Sunday to get to her, and then I came out of the woodline to see her standing there."
As an ambulance whisked her off to hospital, Elizabeth's parents were told the incredible news they had hardly dared hoped for. Madeline would later say,
"When they said they had her, my whole life started again. It was like my heart just started beating again."
Elizabeth might have been safe, but Phil Yore was still on the run and he was a highly dangerous man on a mission. Investigators found evidence of bombs down in the bunker, booby traps meant to seriously hurt or even kill anyone who had attempted to burst in. But though Phil Yore had a 7-hour head start on them, he was about to make a mistake. He attempted to carjack a mother in a neighboring county who began shouting at him until he ran away. She reported the sighting and police swooped in to arrest their fugitive. In custody, Phil Yore spoke to law enforcement, taunting them that he had delighted in watching the panic he'd caused. He said,
"I mean, Elizabeth was on every channel on TV. The police were saying she was a runaway, and her mama was saying she wasn't, and her sister was saying she wasn't. It was exciting."
Soon, officers were unraveling the story of Phil Yore's life. He'd had a tough upbringing as his father died of alcohol poisoning when he was just a year old, and his mother remarried a man who was a substance abuser. As a teenager, he had a love of 80s action movies and the great outdoors, but he began drinking heavily at just 14 and dropped out of school. Eventually, he met mother of three, Cindy Hall, and moved in with her, but soon began abusing one of his stepdaughters. When the 12-year-old girl told deputies he was drugging and molesting her, they began investigating him. To avoid their questions, Fillior fled to hide out in the woods he knew so well, taking with him night vision binoculars, a knife, and a taser. It was there that his hatred for the police began burning, and he set about building his underground lairs. As he hid out under law enforcement's noses and his hate grew, he hatched his monstrous plan.
I came up with the idea to kidnap somebody, draw all of Kershaw County Police into one general area, and then just blow them all up.
Tragically, Elizabeth proved to be his ideal target, and he later callously said,
"She wasn't Elizabeth. She was collateral damage. I was in a game mode. My one and only purpose was to get back at Kershaw County."
In 2007, Fillior faced the consequences of his heinous actions as he prepared to stand trial. He was a man who had terrorized a community and shattered the innocence of a young girl. His defense? He claimed his actions were driven by anger at the authorities, who he felt had mistreated him over the abuse claims. But there would be one more shock when Vincent Fillior sensationally pleaded guilty just minutes before the trial was due to get underway. Instead, he was immediately sentenced to 421 years in prison, convicted of kidnap, first-degree criminal sexual assault, second-degree sexual assault, possession of explosives, attempted armed robbery, and impersonating a police officer. In 2021, Phil Yore was found dead in his South Carolina cell at the age of 51. No cause of death was ever released. Elizabeth went on to rebuild her life and has spoken openly about her experience, hoping to inspire others who have faced similar horrors. Her journey is a powerful reminder that even in the darkest of times, there is hope. Despite the darkness she endured, she emerged stronger, a beacon of hope and courage for others. And there we have it, three stories that reassure us of the resilience of the human spirit, even while they remind us of the evil some can do. That's all from this week's episode. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to tune in next time when we'll be bringing you three more tales of true life terror. Evil Uncovered is brought to you by Bauer Media. Concept and original stories by Steph Seelan and Lisa Howells. Episode written and exec produced by Lisa Howells. Produced and edited by Rick Simmons. AI voices produced and edited by Waldemar Matwash. Episode created with support from WeDaVinci AI Technology.